Hi, I'm Brittany Luce, and welcome to Sampler. If this is your first time listening, or if you're the type who doesn't mind a gentle reminder, Sampler is the show where we play you carefully picked moments from podcasts that you just have to hear. Sometimes I'll have a co-host. This week, again, Gimlet producer Chris Neary. Hey, Chris, welcome back.
Hey, Brittany.
Oh, we should give the warning again.
Yes, this episode contains adult language and themes. So if you've got kids listening, now's the right time to pause.
Okay, so we're going to feature three very different shows on the podcast today. We'll start with a podcast that Chris, you and I both really like, The Combat Jack Show.
Yes, Combat Jack is actually Reggie Osei, a guy who used to be a lawyer for some of the biggest hip-hop artists and now hosts a podcast where he often has guests from the hip-hop world, people like Russell Simmons and Damon Dash and LL Cool J. But the show is a lot more than that. He's a really great interviewer, and basically, if Combat Jack is interested in something, he'll do an episode on it. Besides hip-hop figures, he's talked with civil rights activist Duray McKesson and sports journalist Bomani Jones.
He really just, like, follows his curiosity. And the episode we want to play for you today is Combat Jack's interview with Raymond Santana, one of the Central Park Five. Some background. The Central Park Five were five teenagers who were convicted in 1989 of a brutal rape and assault. It was a huge, huge case in New York at the time, and a lot of the press made the five teenagers out to be monsters. Raymond Santana served about 6 years in prison, but several years after his release, his sentence, along with the rest of the Central Park Five, was vacated after another man confessed to the crime. The five won millions of dollars in a settlement against the city after proving that they were wrongly convicted.
I'd heard Santana interviewed a few times, usually about the night of the attack or his time in prison, but I never heard anyone ask him what Combat Jack did. What were you like as a kid before all this happened?
You'll hear a third voice in this clip. That's Combat Jack's producer, Premium Pete. All right, here is Combat Jack.
What'd you want to be, man? What were your aspirations at 14? I know you said you were trying to, you were coming into your own. We really don't know what we want to be.
We really don't know. I mean, you know, at 14, I used to love to sketch. You know, I used to love to draw.
You read comics?
I loved comics.
What comics were you reading?
You know, some X-Men was my joint.
John Byrne.
Yeah, you know.
that was a golden era.
Yeah. You know, Wolverine, I Spider-Man. I was a big Marvel head. You know, I had boxes. I remember buying Ninja Turtles the first issue. Right. Like, back then,
wow.
You know, I had boxes of comics, and that was my thing, and I used to love to sketch.
So you, in a sense, also kind of like a nerd.
Yeah, almost. You know, I jumped over the fence here and there.
He was a nerd with some swag.
But a lot of us was. You know what I'm saying?
No, like, definitely.
A lot of us was. Like, one of the things that I'll never forget when we had Mano on the show. You know, Mano says a lot of us come from the hood, but all of us aren't necessarily hood.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? The climate was, you know, you'd read your comics, and then when other cats came on the train, you just slid them away just so that you wouldn't get tested.
Yeah, or you kept them in the book bag till you got home.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I used to do. I read them in the crib.
Yeah.
So I had stacks of them in the cribs, and that's where I read all that stuff at.
As the interview goes on, we hear about Santana's life in prison. Being convicted of rape made him the target of attacks that started on his very first day. Combat Jack does a really great job of making his guests feel comfortable, which allows them to share the tiny specific details that really bring their stories to life for the listener. One part where that really comes through in this interview is when Combat Jack asks Santana what his life was like after prison. He got out in 1998, and as a registered sex offender, he had a state-mandated curfew of 7 p.m.
How had the neighborhood changed, man?
The neighborhood was totally different, you know. That 7 years, them kids were like this now. They were older. A lot of people were gone. It was totally different. You know, it wasn't changing as far as with the different cultures yet, you know. But crack era was slowing down.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't that much people out there. It was still those lingering effects from it. But it was rough.
Yeah. And you talk about how your situation changed you. Like how you, you know, wanted to stay in like small rooms.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Like, that's all the effects that come from prison, that I was feeling comfortable. I would sit in my room because it was the size of a cell.
Right.
And I would close the door. And it wasn't until my father said, yo, why you always stay in your room? And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you're always in your room. And I'm like, oh, shit. You know, and I would go in the shower with my boxers on. And I would wash them in the shower and hang them shits up.
Right.
And then I had this pent-up aggression. You know, if I'm in a room with a crowd, a bunch of people, I watch everything moving. And I put my back against the wall, and I scan the whole room. I see what's going on.
That peripheral.
That's right. I'm always on point.
Were you going out, like, to clubs now?
Nah, none of that. There was none of that.
Never.
Like, there was none of, there was no clubs, none of, I mean, my boys and me took me out the first time, yo, but after that, it was done. I had a 7 o'clock curfew.
Yeah, but you didn't like it either, right?
Nah, you know, and I didn't know where to turn. I didn't know what to do. And that's when I started to stumble, you know, because there was no transitional program.
You had no money.
No money.
There so was, you couldn't, were you buying comic books?
Nah.
Couldn't, that was
that
done.
Time,
gone.
That was gone.
Gone.
And, but you know, it would resurface.
Right.
Like I say, let's say I'm by the store. Oh, should I used to read that? I pick one or two up. But overall, I couldn't get back to that. That drive was gone.
The thing that sticks out most to me about this part is how much you can tell prison changed Santana. And you think after being there, he'd enjoy leaving his room or showering privately, but he got so used to his surroundings that he didn't know how to be once he got out. Today, Raymond Santana works with the Innocence Project and Justice League NYC, a group focused on juvenile justice. Okay, I fell in love with this next story we're featuring the moment I heard it. It's from this podcast called The Heart. And The Heart is a show about love and relationships and intimacy told through provocative, oftentimes poignant little narratives. But it's also very much a show about sex, how we have it and sometimes how we don't. The episode I'm going to play for you today is my favorite, and it revolves around a woman in her late 20s named Gina Gold, who was, much to her dismay, a virgin. Now, this was not for lack of trying. She had had boyfriends and sexual relationships, but she was just never able to go all the way. Every time Gina tried to have sex with someone, she felt a wall inside her vagina, a wall that she felt was impossible to get through. In the episode, she talks about the pain of losing her first boyfriend, who dumped her after she wasn't able to have sex with him. After years of repeating this pattern, she finally went to a doctor.
I said to the doctor, I think that there is a wall in my vagina, and she laughed. And I said, no, seriously, there's some deformity. You need to take me seriously. And she said, let's do an exam. And I said, I can't. I cannot have you put the speculum on. I cannot. No. So she said, okay, let's try putting you out. So we actually had this whole big thing where I went to UCSF, got put out, thousands of dollars, and it's just to have a fucking exam. I woke up and I was like, tell me about the wall. And she was like, as I said, told you, there's no wall. You are totally normal. Everything down there works. And I was shocked. She told me that the wall was in my mind, that my body had clamped shut, that the mind is so powerful that it can create a wall that's not there. And that because I felt fearful and apprehensive, I created a barrier that in my mind became a physical barrier. And that this condition is called vaginismus.
Gina now had a name for her condition, but there was still the matter of what to do about it. Her doctor, of course, wanted her to go to a sex therapist to ease her anxieties, but she also suggested that Gina try a less traditional type of therapy, a sex surrogate.
The sex surrogate is the one that actually has physical contact and ultimately may have sex with you. And all this, most sex surrogates were women. I said, I don't want a woman. That's not going to help me. And she said, well, there's only one man in the Bay Area that's available. I go to Berkeley, it's to the guy's house. I knock on the door. He opens the door. He's this older, red-faced, red-necked gentleman with a really bad Massachusetts accent, like Charlestown. And he had a Donald Trump comb over. And I was like, I don't want to fuck you. I'm sorry. I can't do it. Maybe you have something else you can do. So he said, okay, would you be willing to get undressed? I would be willing to get undressed, but don't touch me. Don't fucking touch me. Like, don't look like you're excited about me being naked. So I got undressed. He had a big king size bed that had satin sheets and then a very New England quilt on the top. I opened up my legs, which is a very vulnerable thing to do, on his bed, on that quilt. He just said, "Can I put the mirror in between your legs?" He put the mirror in between my legs and he paced around the room. "All right, Gina. Do you feel yourself in the room? Do you feel yourself naked? Do you see your legs? Do you see your vagina? Do you see your labia? Do you see a clitoris?" "This is my labia. This is my clitoris. This is my outer labia. This is my inner labia. This is my vulva." As I said the words, I heard "this is my," like the "this is my" part was like, "This is my body, and there it is. And there's really nothing mysterious about it." The whole thing had been demystified. I knew that I couldn't have sex with the sex surrogate. But I had been going to Bank of America across the street from the barn, which was my house, for quite some time. And there was this young guy. He was short. He had glasses. And I slipped him a note while I was making a deposit. And I asked him if he would like to come to my house for dinner.
Okay, I don't want to give too much away. There is more to Gina's story, and you should definitely go listen to the whole thing. But you should feel optimistic.
Yes, this tiny bank teller is definitely promising.
Honestly, anything that starts with propositioning a Bank of America employee in the middle of the afternoon is heading in, at a minimum, an interesting direction. I think a cliffhanger is a good way to end the first half of the show. Okay, Sampler will be back in just a moment. After the break, a man losing his sight and his wife losing her patience.
I appreciate that.
Don't tell me you appreciate that.
No, no. Well, what do you want me to say?
I don't know. I don't even know what to say to you.
Hi, I'm Brittany Luce, and welcome back to Sampler. I'm here with my co-host for the day, Gimlet producer Chris Neary. He's got something he wants to share with the class. What do you got, Chris?
I have a podcast hosted by a comedian where he's tracking his rapidly failing eyesight. It's called Going Blind Sucks, which is a solid name, I think. The comedian is Dustin Dodato, and he has retinitis pigmentosa. And that has left him with roughly 9% of his peripheral vision, which is kind of like looking at the world through a paper towel roll. What's really great about this podcast, what sets it apart, is a couple things. For one, it's funny. That's not surprising for a comedian. But I also love the show because Dustin doesn't host it alone. It's him and his wife, Joy. Here's a clip from the show where Dustin and Joy talk about an unusual side effect from a medicine Dustin was taking.
And there's a list of side effects that are there. The list of side effects was all that, like, don't operate a car unless you know blah, 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 and may experience, you know, frequent peeing and blah, blah, you know.
Just constantly leaking.
Yeah. But the one side effect that seemed to just pop out was affecting taste. But the thing is, it only changed the way one thing tasted.
Nothing else.
Nothing else. And for those of you that know me, here's something that is very true. I eat to not die. I don't eat like out of enjoyment. There are only a handful of things that I really enjoy. I love Coca-Cola.
You have it running in your veins.
Yes. And it made me hate Coca-Cola. It made Coca-Cola...
It's cruel.
...taste like medicine.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I was like, look, you're already taking my eyesight.
Leave me my Coca-Cola.
Yes. It seemed like such a...
Why, God, why?
Like, I just like soda. Can I just have my soda?
Oh, my God. God, that's like adding insult to injury.
Right, like the only food that gives him enjoyment, a kind of food that makes you feel up and happy, has just been ruled out for him.
Yeah, God, that's like he doesn't even have that little, like, that creature comfort that he can turn to during this whole period.
Yeah, like, what's your Coke? What would be devastating to lose?
You know, oh, God. All of Mexican food. If all of a sudden Mexican food started tasting terrible,
uh-huh,
I would not be long for this world. I wouldn't.
So you would stop, it sounds like you would stop taking a vital medication to save,
yes,
to be able to
absolutely
eat Mexican food.
That's like not even a question in my mind. That's not even a question.
All right. So you get those kind of really funny moments in the podcast, but you have to keep in mind what's happening to Justin is really traumatic and really scary. And there are times in the podcast where the humor fades away and you get sort of raw, unvarnished emotion. I mean, there's a thread through the whole podcast where Joy wants him to get more treatment and Dustin doesn't. And he sort of feels guilty about it at times, but you get the sense that it's a way that he's maintaining control.
Mm.
Like, I will experience this and help myself at my own pace. The next thing I want to play for you, Brittany, is one of those arguments between Dustin and Joy. And just a note, he says RP in the clip. That's just an abbreviation for his disease.
And I just feel like because you haven't been given any concrete evidence that someone can help make your eyesight better, that you're like, well, then nobody else knows, so why continue doing this? Whereas I'm thinking eventually perhaps someone will say, you know what, actually, I just figured this out, or I just know that this is the gene that does something, and that if we do something to it, maybe it'll make it better. Like, I think it can happen, but I think you have to keep looking. And I just feel like you're like, well, so far, nothing, so screw it.
No, it's not so far nothing, screw it. It's, I don't always, like, trying to always be at the forefront of it or whatever is heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking watching you stop.
I'm not stopping. I've made so much damn progress. I'm doing this podcast, for goodness sake. It's my way of trying to deal with it, you know? I've started using the cane almost all the time. It's my way of trying to deal with it. I've accepted a lot of things. And I went to the genetic test because people wanted me to. You know, if I'm getting more from being on the RP list of emails and stuff like that than I can be from going to a doctor, then why shouldn't I do that instead?
I don't have an answer for you.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I don't mean to be disappointing you.
You're not disappointing me. I'm sure I'm upset just because I want to make things better for you. And if I hear you cutting off an avenue, it's there's less hope. It feels like there's less hope. So that's all.
Thank you.
No.
And No, I know that you're doing it because you care.
I just am hopeful that sometime in the future, they will figure it out. And if we've done everything that we can ahead of time, then maybe you could be first in line for whatever they figured out will fix it.
And I appreciate that. But I don't think...
Don't tell me you appreciate that.
No. What do you want me to say?
I don't know. I don't even know what to say to you. So... But saying thank you, like, thank you, patting me on the head, that's so nice of you, little person.
Well, because I do appreciate it, but I don't necessarily agree that doing genetic testing right now is going to be the thing that's going to make it easier.
Well, okay. Then don't do it. We'll just agree to disagree. Don't do it. I'm not going to make you do it.
I'm not saying you're making me do it. I'm just saying that if they figure out something that cures it tomorrow, okay, you're still 3 years out from me even possibly being able to do it. But everybody's adding this urgency to it. Like, I'm disappointing them by not doing it. You know? And I don't want to disappoint everybody. I don't want to take everybody's fears and concerns on my shoulder all the time and make it so that they feel good about what I'm doing to fight this.
I'm not asking you to do this to make me feel good.
I'm not specifically talking about you in this scenario.
Okay, well, you're yelling at me right now.
And you're right. 100% that if the situation were reversed, I would want you to fight 100% of the time. All the time. Because I would want it to be gone. I wouldn't want you to have to deal with it. But I know that you couldn't. I only know that now. But so when I say I appreciate it, it's not meant to be condescending or patronizing or anything like that. I just don't know what else to say back.
That was very tough. Obviously, like, they're dealing with him having RP, but there are, I would imagine, as an unmarried person, that there are a lot of situations that you can't foresee, like having disagreements about how to handle a health problem, because, like, you're both so invested in the other person's life that, like, you don't have a say, but you also kind of do. So I think it's cool that they put that out there, because that's, I don't know that I would do that. You know what I mean? I don't know that I would do that.
No, and as a married person, I have to say, hearing it, even though there are no stakes that high in my own life right now, mm-hmm. you do get kind of like a chill of recognition of like, this would be a little bit like what an argument in my own life would sound like.
Yeah.
You know, just lower stakes, but still as contentious. And you can hear both resentment and kindness and anger sort of in really quick succession.
Yeah, exactly. In like 30 seconds.
Yeah. So, you know, Brittany, I got really invested in this couple. And then for 3 years, they just stopped doing the show. And I wasn't sure whether he'd gone blind more rapidly than they thought, or it just got too hard to have arguments like we just heard.
Yeah.
On tape.
Yeah.
I had almost forgotten about it. And then the podcast miraculously started back up again late last year. So I called Joy and Dustin to figure out where they went and why they're back. So you took about a 3 year break from the podcast. And for me, it was like losing touch with a couple friends who I know way more about than my actual couple friends. Way, way more. And so why did you decide to start the podcast back up?
It finally felt like a time where there was enough new stuff to say compared to before, where the conclusion we had gotten to was just ask for help more. And now I think we're dealing with things that I can't overcome, that help isn't going to ever come for.
What kind of things are you experiencing that you feel like the cavalry is not on the way?
I used to feel confident that I could see enough and I could get around places. If I had the cane, I could kind of keep it all together. Now I'm in a situation where even with a cane and a flashlight, sometimes I'm still lost. Now I'm realizing that maybe there are just places I can't go anymore. Maybe I have to take a cab every single place that I go. I can't just walk someplace. There's a very strong part of me that's like, maybe I just don't do that anymore. So even when Joy's there and she's helping me, sometimes it makes it better. But I still get into those panic situations. Whereas before, I think as long as I had a hand to hold, I could just do it.
You guys are good about really addressing hard things and like kind of hashing it out in front of other people, basically. And so you've come back with the podcast. Has that helped your relationship?
Silence.
It hasn't harmed it.
Wow.
No,
please,
I mean,
you have to go on after saying that.
I went back and listened to a couple of old episodes, and I realized that, like, it's a very weird experience because I don't think we necessarily fight on the podcast, but we...
Oh, come on. You guys fight sometimes.
Yeah, we fight. Okay. It's very rare that you have a fight with your wife that you record and listen to later. When you're in a fight, you're defending yourself. But when you look back on it later, you're like, oh, I get what they were trying to say. maybe they had a point. Maybe they, the podcast as a whole is good for our relationship because somehow the microphone makes it easier for us to sort of cut to that thing. We can't beat around the bush. Joy is great at that. I give her all the credit. She's the best at like not backing down.
You make me sound like a pit bull.
No, not at all.
Well, I believe that our relationship is really good. I suppose everybody feels that way about their marriage, but
yeah, no, they don't. And also, and I'm not drawing on my own experience, but also I think one of the best things about the podcast is that yes, it does seem like a healthy relationship, even under like a particular unusual kind of stress, but go on.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that goes across. So I think that sometimes when I listen back, I'm just like, oh, I don't know about that. Do I really want people to know about this intimacy that we have and all these sort of things that most people don't record and put into the world? So I don't think that's bad. It's just that there are times when I'm like, should we do this? Is this okay that we're doing this? So I don't think it really hurts the marriage, but there are times where I'm like, I'm not sure who it's helping other than us.
Right. And so why do you do it?
I do it for Dustin for sure. And I think it helps him a lot. And it does help me.
It's one of the few meaningful things that I do in my life. You know, like work is great and it helps, but it's not me. You know, we leave the podcast like super exhausted and super emotionally drained and not sure if we want to share that with the world. The more we don't want to share with the world, the more we should probably share it with the world.
So I remember from the first season, like when you got your diagnosis, it was from a comically old doctor who did not see very well himself. And when you asked him like, hey, so at what point will Dustin be blind? He was like, you're 32 now, let's call it 52.
Yes.
And I wonder, Joy, for you, have you allowed your mind to drift into a time when your husband is blind?
I try not to. Sometimes I do, and that's when I fall to pieces and I need a Xanax. But as his age increases and we get closer to that arbitrary magic number, it's getting a little bit more scary for me.
Can you imagine doing the podcast when you are blind?
I want to say yes, but I'm not sure because I think part of what makes the podcast work is hope. You know, that like, it's like if I was fully blind, then I would just have the rage, the fear and the anger. Now I have the fight, you know, now that I have the like, I'm not going to be this. I'm not going to give into it. And somehow if maybe I just rationalize or argue or discuss it enough, I can mentally beat it. And I think if I was totally blind, I don't know that I could do that as well.
Joy, can you imagine doing the podcast when Dustin is blind?
I can imagine it. I think it would be a bit darker, but I think it might actually be good for him because if this has helped through this stage of it, I think doing it at that stage of complete darkness would also be helpful. And especially if he's going to stay inside more.
Yeah, I'd have more free time. So why not?
So something that I didn't notice as much in the two previous clips as I did in this one is how afraid Joy like is. Even the second one, I felt a lot of sadness, I guess. This last one, it almost seems like on some level, Dustin is accepting the fact that he's going blind. Do you know what I mean?
And right, he has like, some awareness. Yeah,
yeah, and he, because it's happening to him. But I think that hearing her fear, I felt like I heard more of that. And maybe that's like maybe her being afraid in a different way is what makes it easier for her to not shy away when they're having conversations like on the microphone. Maybe because like, you know, I think he said he is not sure if he'd want to do it when he goes completely blind, but I could see like for her, it's still being something that she might need.
Right. And that's why it's so cool that they're doing the podcast together because mm-hmm. it's actually the person who's not going blind that gives you like a more concrete sense of how bad it would be.
Yeah.
So the other thing I liked is that, you know, this is a show about podcasts. And so it's really good to hear that this guy doing his podcast, it's the most meaningful thing in his life.
Yeah. And also, like, it serves this purpose that I never knew that podcasting could serve, which is, like, relationship mediator, in a sense. We listen to a lot of things. We listen to a lot of things here. But like I said, relationship mediator was not what I was expecting. It wasn't even what I was expecting to get out of listening to this show. So thank you.
Cool.
This week's show is like an emotional journey. We went through a lot together, you guys. So thank you so much for listening.
The shows you heard featured this week were The Combat Jack Show, which comes out every other week on the Loudspeakers Network. We also listened to part of an episode from The Heart, which is part of the Radiotopia Network.
And the clips you just heard are from Going Blind Sucks, which is back up and running after a 3-year hiatus. Links to all of those shows will be featured at our site, gimletmedia.com/sampler. As always, we want to hear from you. This week, we're looking for moments from podcasts about people doing things for the very first time. You can find us on Twitter at Sampler Show, and you can always shoot us an email at sampler@gimletmedia.com. This episode of Sampler was produced by Chris Neary, Matthew Nelson, Rose Reed, and myself. It was edited by Alex Bloomberg, Peter Clowney, and Caitlin Kenny, and this episode was mixed by David Herman. Our theme song was written and performed by Micah Velian. Original scoring was done by Peter Kokoma, and our ad music is by Build Buildings. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media.